Chapter 4. I left for Maiden Eggersford a couple of days later in the old two-seater. Jeeves had gone on ahead with the luggage and would be there to greet me on my arrival, no doubt all braced and refreshed from communing with his aunt. It was in jocund mood that I set forth. There were rather more astigmatic loonies sharing the road with me than I could have wished, but that did nothing to diminish my euphoria, as I have heard it called. The weather couldn't have been better. Blue skies and sunshine all over the place. And to put the frosting on the cake, E. Jimpson Murgatroyd had been 100% right about the spots. They had completely disappeared, leaving not a rack behind, and the skin on my chest was back to its normal alabaster. I reached Journey's End at about the hour of the evening cocktail, and got my first glimpse of the rural haven which was to be the Worcester home for I didn't know how long. Well, I had had a sort of idea that there would be what they call subtle, but well-marked differences between Maiden Eggersford and such resorts as Paris and Monte Carlo, and a glance told me I had not erred. It was one of those villages where there isn't much to do except walk down the main street and look at the Jubilee watering trough, and then walk up the main street and look at the Jubilee watering trough from the other side. E. Jimpson Murgatroyd would have been all for it. "Oh, boy," I could hear him saying, "this is the stuff to give the typical young man about town." The air, as far as I could tell from the first few puffs, seemed about as pure as could be expected, and I looked forward to a healthy and invigorating stay. The only thing wrong with the place was that it appeared to be haunted, for as I alighted from the car, I distinctly saw the phantasm, or wraith, of Major Plank. It was coming out of the local inn, the Goose and Grasshopper, and as I gazed at it with bulging eyes, it vanished round a corner, leaving me, I need scarcely say, in something of a twitter. I am not, as I mentioned earlier, a fussy man, but nobody likes to have spectres horsing around, and for a while my jocund mood became a bit blue about the edges. I speedily pulled myself together. 'Twas but a momentary illusion, I said to myself. I reasoned the thing out. If Plank had come to a sticky end since I had seen him last, and had started on a haunting career, I said to myself, why should he be haunting Maiden Eggersford when the whole of equatorial Africa was open to him? He would be much happier scaring the daylights out of natives whom he had cause to dislike, the widows and surviving relatives of the late chief of the Mgombis, for instance. Fortified by these reflections, I went into the cottage. A glance told me it was all right. I think it must have been built for an artist or somebody like that, for it had all the modern cons, including electric light and the telephone, being in fact more a desirable bijou residence than a cottage. Jeeves was there, and he brought me a much-needed refresher, in deference to E. Jimpson Murgatroyd, a dry ginger ale. Sipping it, I decided to confide in him, for in spite of the clarity with which I had reasoned with myself, I was still not altogether convinced that what I had seen had not been a phantom. True, it had looked solid enough, but I believe the best ghosts often do. "Most extraordinary thing, Jeeves," I said. "I could have sworn I saw Major Plank coming out of the pub just now."
"No doubt you did, sir. Major Plank would be quite likely to come to the village. He is the guest of Mr. Cook of Eggersford Court."
"You could have knocked me down with a cheese straw. You mean he's here?"
"Yes, sir."
I was astounded. When he had told me he was off to the country, I had naturally assumed that he meant he was returning to his home in Gloucestershire. Not, of course, that there's any reason why someone who lives in Gloucestershire shouldn't visit Somerset. Aunt Dahlia lives in Worcestershire, and she was visiting Somerset. You have to look at these things from every angle. Nevertheless, I was perturbed. I'm not sure I like this, Jeeves.
No, sir.
He may remember what our last meeting was all about.
It should not be difficult to avoid him, sir.
Something in that. Still, what you say has given me a shock. Plank is the last person I want in my neighbourhood. I think, as my nervous system has rather taken the knock, we might discard this ginger ale and substitute for it a dry martini.
Very good, sir.
Murgatroyd will never know.
Precisely, sir.
And so, having breathed considerable quantities of pure air and taken a couple of refreshing looks at the Jubilee watering trough, to bed early, as recommended by E. Jimpson Murgatroyd. The result of this following of doctor's orders was sensational. Say what you might about his whiskers, and his habit of looking as if he had been attending the funeral of a dear friend, E. Jimpson knew his job. After about 10 hours of restful sleep,
I sprang from between the sheets, leapt to the bathroom, dressed with a song on my lips, and headed for the breakfast table like a 2-year-old. I had cleaned up the eggs and bee, and got the toast and marmalade down the hatch to the last crumb, with all the enthusiasm of a tiger of the jungle tucking into its ration of coolie, and was smoking a soothing cigarette, when the telephone rang, and Aunt Delia's voice came booming over the wire. "Hello, old ancestor," I said, and it was a treat to hear me, so full of ginger and loving kindness was my diction. "A very hearty good morning to you, aged relative."
"You got here, have you?"
"In person."
"So you're still alive? The spots didn't turn out to be fatal?"
"They've entirely disappeared," I assured her. "Gone with the wind."
"That's good. I wouldn't have liked introducing a piebald nephew to the Briscoes, and they want you to come to lunch today."
"Vastly civil of them.
Have you a clean collar?"
"Several, with immaculate shirts attached."
"Don't wear that Drones Club tie."
"Certainly not," I agreed. "If the Drones Club tie has a fault, it is a little on the loud side, and should not be sprung suddenly on nervous people and invalids, and I had no means of knowing if Mrs. Briscoe was one of these." "What time is the binge?"
1:30.
"Expect me then, with my hair in a braid." The invitation showed a neighbourly spirit which I applauded, and I said as much to Jeeves. "They sound good eggs, these Briscoes."
"I believe they give uniform satisfaction, sir."
"Aunt Delia didn't say where they lived."
"At Eggesford Hall, sir."
"How does one get there?"
"One proceeds up the main street of the village to the high road, where one turns to the left. You cannot miss the house. It is large and stands in extensive grounds. It is a walk of about 1.5 miles, if you are intending to walk."
"I think I'd better. Murgatroyd would advise it. You, I take it, in my absence, will go and hobnob with your aunt. Have you seen her yet?"
No, sir. I learn from the lady behind the bar of the Goose and Grasshopper, where I looked in on the night of my arrival, that she has gone to Liverpool for her annual holiday."
"Liverpool, egad! Sometimes one feels that aunts live for pleasure alone. I made an early start. If these Briscoes were courting my society, I wanted to give them as much of it as possible. Reaching the high road, where Jeeves had told me to turn to the left, I thought I had better make sure. He had spoken confidently, but it is always well to get a second opinion. And by Jove, I found that he had goofed. I accosted a passing centenarian. Everybody in Maiden Eggesford seemed to be about 150, no doubt owing to the pure air, and asked which way I turned for Eggesford Court, and he said to the right. It just showed how even Jeeves can be mistaken. On one point, however, he had been correct. A large house, he had said, standing in extensive grounds, and I had been walking what must have been 1.5 miles, when I came in sight of just such a residence, standing in grounds such as he had described. There were gates opening on a long drive, and I was starting to walk up this, when it occurred to me that I could save time by cutting across country, because the house I could see through the trees was a good deal to the nor-nor-east. They make these drives winding so as to impress visitors. "Bless my soul," the visitor says, "this drive must be 3/4 of a mile long. Shows how rich this chap is." Whether I was singing or not, I can't remember, more probably whistling, but be that as it may, I made good progress, and I had just come abreast of what looked like stables when there appeared from nowhere a cat. It was a cat of rather individual appearance, being black in its general colour scheme, but with splashes of white about the ribs and also on the tip of its nose. I chirruped and twiddled my fingers, as is my custom on these occasions, and it advanced with its tail up and rubbed its nose against my leg in a manner that indicated clearly that in Bertram Wooster it was convinced that it had found a kindred soul and one of the boys. Nor had its intuition led it astray. One of the first poems I ever learnt, I don't know who wrote it, probably Shakespeare, ran, "I love little pussy, her coat is so warm, and if I don't hurt her, she'll do me no harm. And that's how I've been all my life. Ask any cat with whom I have had dealings what sort of a chap I am cat-wise, and it will tell you that I am a thoroughly good egg in whom complete confidence can safely be placed. Cats who know me well, like Aunt Dahlia's Augustus, will probably allude to my skill at scratching them behind the ear. I scratched this one behind the ear, and it received the attention with obvious gratification, purring like the rumble of distant thunder. Cordial relations having now been established, I was proceeding to what you might call phase 2, viz., picking it up in my arms in order to tickle its stomach, when the welkin was split by a stentorian high." There are many ways of saying high. In America, it is a pleasant form of greeting, often employed as a substitute for good morning. Two friends meet. One of them says, "Hi, Bill." The other replies, "Hi, George." Then Bill says, "Is this hot enough for you?" And George says that what he minds is not the heat but the humidity, and they go on their way. But this "hi" was something very different. I believe the sort of untamed savages Major Plank mixes with do not go into battle shouting "hi," but if they did, the sound would be just like the uncouth roar which had nearly shattered my eardrums. Turning, I perceived a red-faced little half-portion, brandishing a hunting crop I didn't much like the look of. I had never been fond of hunting crops, since at an early age I was chased for a mile across difficult country by an uncle armed with one who had found me smoking one of his cigars. In frosty weather I can still feel the old wounds. But now I wasn't really perturbed. This, I took it, was the Colonel Briscoe who had asked me to lunch, and though at the moment he had the air of one who would be glad to dissect me with a blunt knife, better conditions would be bound to prevail as soon as I mentioned my name. I mean, you don't ask a fellow to lunch and start assaulting and battering him as soon as he clocks in. I mentioned it accordingly, rather surprised by his size, for I had thought they made colonels somewhat larger. Still, I suppose they come in all sizes, like potatoes, or, for the matter of that, girls. Vanessa Cook, for instance, was definitely on the substantial side, whereas others who had turned me down from time to time were practically midgets. "Worcester Bertram," I said, tapping my chest. I had anticipated an instant cooling of the baser passions, possibly a joyful cry, and a "How are you, my dear fellow, how are you?" accompanied by a sunny smile of welcome. But nothing of the sort occurred. He continued to effervesce, his face now rather pretty purple.
"What are you doing with that cat?"
he demanded hoarsely. I preserved a dignified calm. I didn't like his tone, but then one often doesn't like people's tones. "Merely passing the time of day," I replied, with a suavity that became me well.
"You were making away with it."
"Making a what?"
"Stealing it."
I drew myself up to my full height, and I shouldn't be surprised if my eyes didn't flash. I've been accused of a good many things in my time, notably by my Aunt Agatha, but never of stealing cats, and the charge gave deep offence to the Worcester pride. Heated words were on the tip of my tongue, but I kept them in status quo, as the expression is. After all, the man was my host. With an effort to soothe, I said, "You wrong me, Colonel. I wouldn't dream such a thing."
"Yes, you would, yes, you would, yes, you would. And don't call me Colonel."
It was hardly an encouraging start, but I tried again. "Nice day."
"Damn the day."
"Crops coming on nicely."
"Curse the crops."
"How's my aunt?"
"How the devil should I know how your aunt is?"
I thought this odd. When you've got an aunt staying with you, you ought to be able to supply inquirers with a bulletin, if only a sketchy one, of her state of health. I began to wonder if the little shrimp I was chatting with wasn't a bit fuzzy in the upper story. Certainly, as far as the conversation had gone at present, he would have aroused the professional interest of any qualified brain specialist. But I didn't give up. We Worcesters don't. I tried another tack altogether. "It was awfully kind of you to ask me to lunch," I said. I don't say actually frothed at the mouth. There was no question, however, that my words had displeased him.
"Ask you to lunch? Ask you to lunch? I wouldn't ask you to lunch."
I think he was about to add, "with a 10-foot pole." But at this moment from off stage, there came the sound of a robust tenor voice singing what sounded like the song hit from some equatorial African musical comedy. And the next moment Major Plank appeared, and the scales fell from my eyes. Plank being on the premises meant that this wasn't the Briscoe residence by a damn sight. By losing faith in Jeeves and turning to the right on reaching the high road, instead of to the left, as he had told me to, I had come to the wrong house. For an instant I felt like blaming the centenarian, but we Worcesters are fair-minded, and I remembered that I had asked him the way to Eggersford Court, which this joint presumably was, and if you say court when you mean hall, there's bound to be confusion. "Good Lord," I said, suffused with embarrassment, "aren't you Colonel Briscoe?" He didn't deign to answer that one, and Plank started talking.
"Why, hello, Worcester," he said. "Who would ever thought of seeing you here? I didn't know you knew Cook."
"Do you know him?"
said the purple chap, evidently stunned by the idea that I could have a respectable acquaintance.
Of course I know. Met him by place in Gloucestershire, though under what circumstances I've forgotten. It'll come back, but at the moment all I know is that he's changed his name. It used to be something beginning with Al, and now it's Worcester. I suppose the original name was something ghastly, which he couldn't stand any longer. I knew a man at the United Explorers who changed his name from Buggins to Westmacott Trevelyan. I thought it very sensible of him, but it didn't do him much good, poor chap, because he'd scarcely got used to assigning his IOUs Gilbert Westmacott Trevelyan when he was torn asunder by a lion. Still, that's the way it goes. How did you come out with the doctor, Worcester? Was it bubonic plague?
I said, no, not bubonic plague. And he said he was glad to hear it, because bubonic plague was no joke, ask anyone.
You staying in these parts?
No, I have a cottage in the village.
Pity, you could have come here. Been company for Vanessa, but you'd join us at lunch.
Said Plank, who seemed to think that a guest is entitled to issue invitations to his host's house, which any good etiquette book would have told him is not the case. I'm sorry, I said. I'm lunching at Eggersford Hall with the Briscoes. This caused Cook, who had been silent for some time, probably having trouble with his vocal cords, to snort visibly.
I knew it. I was right. I knew you were Briscoe's hireling.
What are you talking about, Cook? Asked Plank, not abreast.
Never mind what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about. This man is in the pay of Briscoe, and he came here to steal my cat.
Why would he steal your cat?
You know why he'd steal my cat. You know as well as I do that Briscoe stops at nothing. Look at this man. Look at his face. Guilt written all over it. I caught him with the cat in his arms. Hold him there, Plank, while I go and telephone the police.
And so saying, he legged it. I confess to being a little uneasy when I heard him tell Plank to hold me, because I had had experience of Plank's methods of holding people. I believe I mentioned earlier that at our previous meeting he had proposed to detain me with the assistance of his Zulu Nob Kerry, and he had in his grasp now a stout stick, which, if it wasn't a Zulu Nob Kerry, was unquestionably the next best thing. Fortunately, he was in a friendly mood.
You mustn't mind Cook, Worcester. He's upset. He's been having a spot of domestic trouble. That's why he asked me to come and stay. He thought I might have advice to offer. He allowed his daughter Vanessa to go to London to study art at the Slade, if that's the name of the place, and she got in with the wrong crowd, got pinched by the police and so on and so forth, upon which Cook did the heavy father and jerked her home and told her she'd got to stay there till she learned a bit of sense. She doesn't like it, poor girl, but I tell her she's lucky not to be in Equatorial Africa, because there, if a daughter blots her copybook, her father chops her head off and buries her in the back garden. Well, I hate to see you go, Worcester, but I think you better be off. I don't say Cook will be back with a shotgun, but you never know. I'd leave if I were you.
His advice struck me as good. I took it.